This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. May Barenbaum used to be terrified of insects. Now she studies them and teaches students about them. Of course, she's not above playing to her students' anxieties. This Saturday, she hosts her annual Insect Fear Film Festival at the University of Illinois, where she heads the entomology department. Aren't you glad you've never been pursued by giant, blood-sucking parasites like the poor characters in the film Ticks?
What is it?
Ixodes damini, judging from the mandibles and the pseudo-head, a wood tick.
Ticks do not get this big.
It's a tick. Severely altered, but a tick all the same.
What happened to it?
The specimen has been covered with something. Possibly an herbal steroid.
Steroid?
It's illegal, but some of the farmers up here use it on their marijuana fields to accelerate growth. But that's between us, understand?
What if there are more of these out there?
What we do know is out there is plenty of insect films. We'll hear about May Barenbaum's Insect Fear Film Festival in a few minutes. First, let's hear a little bit about the real world of insects, which I think you'll agree is usually creepy enough. Barenbaum writes about insect life in her new book, Bugs in the System. She says that 80% of the world's species are insects, so it's not altogether surprising that insects can be found just about everywhere.
There are insects that live, for example, flies, small flies that live in petroleum pools, you know, so pools of crude oil. And they swim about happily waiting for fellow insects without the capacity to live in crude oil to fall in and get mired, and that's what they eat. There are insects that live in glaciers, which would seem to be anathema to a cold-blooded organism. There are insects that live inside the nostrils of sea lions, which hardly seems like an enviable sort of place to live. There are insects that, mosquitoes, for example, that breed in baptismal fonts. There are, in fact, mosquitoes that can breed in coal mines that are a mile below the surface. So there are insects just about everywhere you look.
You point out that insects owe their success to physiological and anatomical innovations that often give them the competitive edge over other animals. For example, they're really small in size. Well, how does that help insects adapt?
Well, being small allows an insect or any organism to partition up the environment more to a finer degree than a larger organism can. Insects that eat plants, for example, can concentrate their efforts on particular parts of individual species, whereas a large grazing mammal like a bison or a horse has to consume many different kinds of plants in a relatively large area. So that's how it comes to be that insects can live, for example, inside your box of grape nuts or Wheaties or whatever and find all the material needs met in just a simple box of cereal.
Why do insects have hard shells?
The external skeleton, the exoskeleton, serves the same basic function as our internal skeleton. It's kind of an anchor for our muscles so we can move our limbs around. But from the insect point of view, it's a lot more efficient. Being small, they have a relatively limited amount of material to work with. And it's a general rule of physics that for a given amount of material, a hollow rod supports greater weight than does a solid rod using the same amount of material. This is why, for example, lawn furniture, aluminum lawn furniture, is tubular. It's not made of solid bars of aluminum because it would bend. So with a limited amount of material, you get nice jointed appendages that can bear a lot of weight because it's a hard external skeleton. They serve as very good anchors for muscles, and they're very efficient in that way.
What are the drawbacks of carrying around this hard shell?
Well, no one has yet devised an external skeleton that grows with you. It's kind of like outgrowing your jeans and not being able to button the top button. When you get bigger, you have to get rid of that external skeleton and come up with a new one. So all organisms that have this hard external skeleton, all arthropods, have to, during the course of their life, shed that skeleton at regular or sometimes irregular intervals, and that's a relatively vulnerable point in the insect's life cycle to shed the hard skin and be without it for some length of time.
Which are the insects that do that?
That shed their skin?
Mm-hmm. They're
everybody, all insects, all arthropods, all. Well, the when I use the term arthropod, I mean the phylum Arthropoda. This is the larger category to which the class Insecta belongs. All jointed-legged animals with external skeletons. So it includes not just insects, but spiders and horseshoe crabs and ticks and mites and scorpions and the like.
Spiders shed their shell?
Oh, yeah, regularly. In fact, unlike insects, they continue to shed their skin into their adulthood, into past sexual maturity.
So how come I've never seen spider shells kicking around?
Well, as I mentioned, when an insect molts, it's pretty vulnerable. Once the old skin is shed, it takes a while for the new skin to harden. And during that time, an insect is virtually defenseless, kind of like a knight in armor without his armor, standing in his underwear or something, very vulnerable to the elements.
So because an insect is very vulnerable when it sheds its exoskeleton, does it do it in hiding someplace out of our sight?
Yeah, generally any kind of arthropod in the process of molting is going to do it in some sort of concealed place where it's less exposed to the dangers that arthropods face on a daily basis.
Why can insects walk up walls or crawl across ceilings, defying the laws of gravity?
Rather than defying the laws of gravity, what they're doing are obeying other physical laws. When organisms are very small, their life tends to be dominated not by forces that act on mass or volume, as we are, but rather that by forces that act on surface area. When you get to be very small, the relative ratio of surface area to volume, the sort of covering versus the weight, approaches unity. So insects have, per unit volume, more surface area than we do. And there are a lot of physical forces that are determined by surface area rather than by volume. And one of them is, well, gravity works on mass or volume. So we try to scale a wall, we're immediately brought down back down to the ground by gravity. When an insect tries to scale a wall, the forces of adhesion, which is a surface-related phenomenon, are greater than the forces of gravity. So flies have these little suction cups, and that's all they need on their feet, all they need to just scale a wall and walk upside down on the ceiling. There aren't suction cups really strong enough to for us to counteract the effects of gravity.
Do centipedes and ants have those little suction cups on their feet too?
There are tarsal claws, but whether they don't have the same general sort of structure. But even without, you know, dust clings to walls without suction cups, so you don't even need suction cups per se. That gives you an extra firm footing. But the principles of or the forces of friction and adhesion will allow an insect to cling to a surface more efficiently if it's smaller than if it's bigger.
My guest is May Barenboim. She's written a new book called The Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about bugs. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about insects, and my guest, May Barenboim, is the author of the new book, The Bugs in the System. I want you to help me to understand something, and that's dust mites. And I always figured, well, you know, dust, look, who needs it? It's hard to clean. It's annoying. It makes you sneeze. But I never thought of little insects living in the dust. And I not too long ago became aware through books of dust mites. I mean, through reading about them in books. And I still don't really understand whether dust mites are microorganisms or whether they're actually little insects.
They're actually neither. They're mites, which are not insects. They're members of the class Arachnida. So their closest relatives that are sort of high profile would be spiders.
Well, that's not reassuring.
And the dust, that's really illustrates the point of how easily you can make a living if you're small. What dust mites do, Dermatophagoides tyrannosinus is the name of the species. They live on, among other things, skin flakes shed by larger vertebrate organisms, particularly skin flakes that are overgrown by molds and fungi. So you can make a living eating somebody's dandruff.
Well, some of us would like to believe that what we can't see can't hurt us. Do dust mites cause problems?
Well, they are potentially harmful for anyone with allergies. Generally, if you've been diagnosed with an allergy to dust, what you really have is an allergy in many cases to dust mites, dust mite body parts, and dust mite excrement. So if you are afflicted with asthma or any other condition that's exacerbated by dust, then potentially dust mite infestation can prove very difficult or dangerous.
Now, do you get a creepy feeling thinking of little bugs inhabiting the dust?
Well, if you want to get creepy feelings, dust mites are not your biggest concern. There's also the face mite, which is even creepier. Yeah.
Okay, what's that?
This is a Demodex folliculorum. This is a little mite that lives on people's faces in the follicles, in the at the base of the hairs on the face, particularly around the eyebrows. And again, a very high proportion of the human population harbors populations of face mites on their faces.
Can you see them?
Well, most of the time they're concealed inside the hair follicle, so they're not sort of running around out on your face. But under some circumstances, if you pull out eyebrow hairs and look under the microscope, yeah, you can see them clinging to the end.
Now, do most of us have these mites, and how would we know if we do?
The vast majority of the population does have a few face mites. As to how you know they're there, you don't, really. In most cases, they're completely innocuous, and they don't cause any real complications. In some cases, they can cause problems of inflammation of the skin and the like, but these are the rare exceptions. They are just happy little commensals sharing our sebaceous secretions with us.
Oh, yeah. Well, they might be happy, but I'm not happy to hear about it. Was there a time when you were first learning about dust mites and face mites that you started to
itch? Yes.
Yes, first to itch and to feel bad wherever you looked.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Given how creepy insects can be, why do you study them?
Well, they're fascinating. They're amazing. And that's really only half the story. Insects contribute to human good, I think, in a greater magnitude than any other class of organisms on the planet, really.
Now, I know one of the things that you do at the University of Illinois is you show an insect film festival.
An insect fear film festival.
An insect fear film festival. Yeah. So you show movies where insects take over the world?
Basically, yeah.
Which movies?
Oh, geez, well, we're in our 12th year, so we've shown a lot of them. We often organize the festival around themes. So we had an all-cockroach festival one year, and this year we're doing parasites.
What are you showing this year?
We're hoping to show Brain Eaters, which is a 1958 film about Carboniferous-era maggots that latch onto the back of your neck and take over your personality. One called Skeeters and one called Ticks. These are films from the early 90s, plus a number of animated films, short cartoons about parasites, fleas, and mosquitoes and the like, of which there are many.
And what's your educational reason for showing the Insect Fear Film Festival?
Well, a long time ago, I figured that more people would pack into an auditorium to see Mothra or Beginning of the End than would come in to hear a lecture on insect physiology. So what we do is show the movies, and while they're sitting there, before the movie begins, give short introductory remarks on why what they're about to see can't possibly happen and the reasons for it. We also use the festival as an opportunity to show people the real insects behind the media hype, the Hollywood hype. So it's a rare opportunity for people to meet the stars.
Do you have a favorite, do you have a current favorite bug film?
Oh, I have an all-time favorite bug film.
What is it?
Beginning of the End. This is a 1957 Burt I. Gordon film about giant grasshoppers induced by radiation experiments in a USDA lab in Rantoul, Illinois, that move through central Illinois, converge on Chicago, and end up drowning in Lake Michigan after scaling the Wrigley Building.
And what do you tell your students about why this could never happen?
Well, you can't have giant insects. Giant grasshoppers would be a physiological impossibility for several reasons. First of all, when they get that big, if they had to shed their skin or molt, gravity would basically flatten them before sclerotization, before this skin hardening can take place. Secondly, because of the nature, the structure of insect appendages, you have joints that are weight-bearing, very small joints that are weight-bearing, kind of like how high heels tend to concentrate weight. Well, you'd have to have joints made of diamonds. I mean, cuticle's hard, but it's not hard enough to bear all that weight. And finally, insects breathe in a different way from the way we breathe. They have a system of interconnecting tubes that get smaller and smaller branches throughout the entire body and delivers oxygen directly to every cell through tinier and tinier tubes. Well, that works if you're small, but if you get big and you don't have a system to move the air through that system of tubes, then you just insects would not get enough oxygen to provide their energy needs, and if they were indeed that big, they'd be sort of lying flat on the ground panting.
Well,
if an insect could pant.
I feel good knowing that grasshoppers aren't going to take over the world. That's good news. May Barenbaum, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks.
May Barenbaum is the author of Bugs in the System. She chairs the entomology department at the University of Illinois, where she hosts her Insect Fear Film Festival this weekend. This is Fresh Air.